We've won again.
This is good. But what is best in life?
How about
wrong!
I would summon a demon more ferocious than all in hell!
Wrong!
That is what I'm saying, Marshall.
Wrong!
Conan, what is best in life? Crush your enemy, see them driven before you, and let a lamentation of your women. That is this.
Contemplate this on the tree of woe.
Howdy, 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 the long-anticipated return of Garage Gamer. Here we are, Garage Gamer 5. Sitting next to me is
Christopher Barnett.
And Skip Stevenson.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, my God. That was fantastic.
You just stole your thunder.
It's
the dumbest thunder ever. The dumbest thunder ever.
Oh, dear Lord. Okay.
So Garage Gamer.
I'm Dave Witek. And with us, if you haven't recognized the sultry tones,
the dulcet
tones of our good friend, here is Mr. Brian Steele. Come to see us today.
Hello, everyone.
And Brian's here to talk about the game that we just got a nice demo of.
Actually, we got the perfect guest because we are talking today about Dark Age.
Dark Age Apocalypse.
Now, it just so happens that you're working with them now.
Yes.
All right.
Fully and officially.
And I suppose that's a fair disclaimer that Brian's on and we're talking about the game and he actually works for the company. I suppose we ought to throw that out there.
Well, congratulations.
Nice,
yeah, congrats,
nice
man.
Thank you. It is actually due to, I'm going to give a little shout out of my own to my friend Kevin Clark, who is the gentleman, he's one of the main guys over there in the organizational department at CoolMiniOrNot.com. Excuse me.
Actually, I've sung the praises of Cool Mini or Not many times. I love the company.
He actually does sing their praises, too. It's
Cool Mini or Not.
.com.
Now, Cool Minis really come into their own, too, especially with
especially since the Crystal Brush.
With the Crystal Brush. But even before that, I just remember people, you know, I didn't know what it was. I just kind of thought it was a place to go show your paintwork. And have people sort of give you some actually really harsh criticism, because I saw stuff on there that I couldn't do if you gave me a million years. And people were like, it's about a 7 or an 8. And I was like, dear Lord.
Because the internet is for people to be angry upon. Mm-hmm. Or to listen to cool podcasts.
Oh, well, that thing. I hope you meant ours. But, no, I mean,
yeah,
cool,
we're on there too.
Place to check and see some really fantastic work. And now suddenly it's like they're making stuff. They've got games coming out. They...
Cool Mini basically has transformed into kind of like a middle of the road routing system for lots of miniature games. Dark Age, Soda Pop Miniatures, who recently came out with Super Dungeon Explore,
which we were talking about when you first got here,
which is a miniature based board game, which is fantastic. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at it at your local game store, please do. But they basically help find distribution and demo teams and things like that for all these little game companies out there, or I shouldn't say little, game companies that may not have the same kind of clout and oomph that some of the larger ones do.
Right.
So games like Dark Age or I'm trying to think one of the other Soda Pop games right now, and it's Ascension Knights, I think. I'm trying to remember what the actual name of the game is, but it's almost like a 40 millimeter scale game. It's awesome. They've got all these other miniatures that Cool Money has been showing for years, and now they're actually in charge of sales. They've got their own store and gallery on the Cool Money website, and they sell, I mean, all of the Dark Age minis that we're going to be talking about today are sold through Cool Money.
Cool. Mini.
And it's because my dear friend Kevin, who I actually met through my years at Privateer a few months back, you know, six months or so ago, I was talking to him and I was like, you know, I really need more work. You know, work is nice. I like money. And he was like, well, let me see what I can do. His position at Cool Mini is kind of a coordinator of these other companies. So he put the feelers out and he's like, well, email this guy, email this guy, email this guy. And Dark Age was the first one to come out, to come to me and say, well, you wrote a bunch of stuff for War Machine, and we like writing, and we would like you to help us out with fluff stuff.
So are you working primarily on fiction, or are you also working on any of the game design?
Right now, I'm just doing fiction and narrative. I'm talking with BJ at Dark Age right now to try and get into some design stuff. I have lots of ideas, and he has said nice things, but nothing is official.
So something to look forward to, something to hope for.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on my own time and dime. I'm drawing up some extra stuff kind of on the side, and I plan to reveal it to him and say, hey, what do you think about this, and see what cool. he says. But my contract right now is just fiction and fluff.
But officially, you're working for Cool Mini or Not. That is who you're working with. Is that correct?
I am working with through Cool Mini or Not. Cool Mini or Not, for lack of a better term, they're kind of like talent agency for me at the moment.
Okay. You know,
they're sort of peddling me to through Kevin is kind of peddling me to these other companies, and so up to the other companies to make the decision to use me.
Okay. See, I think I noticed them the first time through what is the name of that series of miniatures? Game Zone.
Okay. Okay.
I saw a lot of stuff that I really liked and I wanted to be able to use with Warhammer armies. And once I went to Gen Con and saw just how big mm-hmm. Cool Mini or Not actually was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when you start to see the Soda Pop, the Dark Age, and a lot of the other miniature lines.
McVay Studios has a game line. I'm really eager to get a show. I've talked to Mike at Gen Con.
I've worked with
Mike and Allie before, yeah. and we haven't worked together since Privateer.
2003?
I'd say 2003 or 4. So it's been, you know, 6 or 7, 8 years since I've had a chance to work with Mike again, and I can't wait. I like what he's got anyway. I like the look of his stuff. So, you know, it's just neat to have that opportunity.
Is he sculpting now? Or he was always known for painting. Like, when I first heard Mike McVay, even before Allison really showed her stuff, he was painting for heavy metal in the White Dwarf magazines.
Yeah. As far as I know, I'm not sure. I know he designed the game that he's working on, and right now, because I am a bad Cool Mini or Not contractor, I can't remember what Mike's game is.
McVayStudios.com. You can just Google
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's actually a fun site anyway.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of pretty stuff on there, and Allie's paint jobs are extraordinary.
Okay, so let's move on to talking about this Dark Age here.
Yeah.
Now, we got a cool demo game. It's a skirmish level, alternating activation based game. It runs on D20s, which is different from a lot of the other systems.
Well, it's very similar to a particular couple of systems that died out a few years ago, which is part of the reason I was so excited to see it. It's based on those games that I've talked about before, Warzone and Chronopia. I mean, it's obviously influenced by that system. It is, frankly, it appears to be that system.
There's an extremely heavy feel between the two rule sets. Yeah.
Which is funny, because I sat there and read through the rule book all these times, like, okay, I feel like I got it, and Chris came in, and we were asking questions, and I'm like, I hadn't actually seen you to give you the book to go through the rule set.
Right.
But I know, Brian, you had told me it's very similar to this, and I told Chris that, and he's like, oh, I know that game. Chris, I think, understood the game better than I did, and I actually read the rule set, but after you kind of explained a few things, he's like, oh, it's like that. Oh, yeah, I got that. I remember that.
The core engine feels extremely, extremely close to...
There are a few details that you need to focus on, but what that means is, it means that it's going to be an awful lot of fun to play, and... Yeah. If you struggle with other games that are turn-based where you feel like, I didn't even get to go and I've already lost, it's not going to be that way in this game. Everyone's going to get a turn. Everyone's going to get to go.
Yes. It reminded me in many ways of, like, with Malifaux, where I get to move a guy, you get to move a guy, I get to move a guy, you get to move a guy. But then also a little more like War Machine in that some of the guys are entire squads.
It's a good combination.
So
for newer players, it's a very good combination between the rule sets for War Machine and for Malifaux, where you have units of individual models. You have large squads of units. Well, to use the terminology that Dark Age, a unit is an individual model.
Every single little model, whether it's a tiny little pud, which is a legitimate term, all the way up to the super gigantic trueborn aliens, they are all units. Whether or not they're an individual or a squad is the differential of how many of them activate per turn.
But some units work alone, and some units work in squads. And when you activate, you activate either an individual who's working on their own, or you would have to activate a squad that works in tandem.
Correct.
And then it goes back and forth to your opponent, and they'll be able to activate something until both sides have activated all their units. All their units,
correct.
Their squads.
Correct, yeah.
So, okay. Well, do we want to start with a little bit of the fluff first?
That seems like an appropriate thing.
So
let's talk about the universe.
Fluff.
I like that.
So is it appropriate to say that this is a universe or just a world, a galaxy?
The game focuses on a world in a greater galaxy, but really because of the technology levels and such, the people that you're going to be dealing with on this planet, which is now known as Samaria, if dealing with that particular planet, they have no clue or aspirations about anything off of this planet, because the idea of getting in a car and driving across country is a big deal. The idea of getting on a spaceship, that's just not going
to
happen.
That would be as realistic as my expectation to get off this planet, which is to say almost impossible.
It would be your expectations of getting off the planet in 1960.
So
the only people,
not even a consideration.
Yeah, you would not even dare to dream.
You know that space travel is possible because that's how you got here.
Well, your ancestors got here. Yeah.
So there was this group called the United Worlds,
the UW,
which is thousands, even millions of planets.
Not quite millions. It's huge. Okay. It's huge. But it's at this point, history has changed. It could have been five worlds. But fluff-wise, it's probably in the thousands.
Okay. So there was a United Galaxy.
Yeah.
United under a single flag.
Under a single flag or a single group of flags. The government itself is kind of amorphous because...
For clarity, this implies all humans?
It was based off of an Earthen idea. That was where the UW kind of sprang from.
Okay. So, I mean, all of these planets were colonized by humanity from Earth.
It's correct. Not like Star Trek with tons of alien life forms. It's humanity.
They ran into alien life forms. We know that. We know that they have had and possibly there were alien worlds in the UW.
But the history is partially lost, so we do not know their relationships.
Exactly.
Okay.
For all we know, there could be a bunch of aliens out there that were part of the UW that have nothing to do with this whatsoever.
Okay. But there was this United Worlds.
Yes.
And we're dealing with the human side of it.
Correct.
Now... So what happens is the UW, the government itself, collapses.
They send out probes to expand.
Okay.
Constantly. You know, they go out to send little probe ships and scout ships to go see other worlds to find out their worth. And eventually they find this planet, which we had the number system. It's a Q. It starts with a Q.
It was,
and it's
so
got another Q.
In effect, the planet the Dark Age revolves about, the planet that the Dark Age is about, was just a numbered entity that had no...
It was a blip on a map.
Okay.
A23-Q4B.
Ah, Q4B.
And for you kids at home, there will be a quiz later, so be sure to get your number two pencils.
It has been given one of the lowest grades available to planets that didn't simply vaporize human beings within seconds, and that rating was D3, unfit for permanent human habitation.
The UW.
That's a nice place to set your game.
Yeah, the UW found this world, and they're like, you know, initial surface scans say it's got a lot of minerals and stuff on it. It's going to be useful. And then they send the probes down and go, wow, this place is a hellhole. You know, this would be just too expensive to actually settle. It isn't worth it. Everybody's going to be running around in viro suits. Yeah, everyone's going to be living in bubbles. This just isn't going to work out.
Okay.
And so... They stamp it on the map that, nope, this world sucks. We're not adding it to the UW. Well, because, as with any future society, there are extremely powerful super corporations out there who have spies everywhere. They find out about this world. You know, through their ties in the government, they find that this world exists, and they find out that this world is officially not part of the UW. It's a planet filled with resources.
It's outside of the government's control and influence.
Yeah, by the government's own decision. I mean, it's not like they're sneaking this. It's just...
It's fiscally viable, but it's incredibly hostile.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so they decide, well, we're going to go send... We're going to use this planet as a staging ground for a lot of industry, a lot of mining, a lot of things that they can get away with because there's no government there to tax them, to tariff their exports.
And they can do illegal activities.
So or to watch over them.
There is no overwatch, no government entity, so...
They have free reign.
It's free reign.
And so,
so they can do even illegal stuff. They can do illegal genetical experiments.
Things that the government doesn't want them to do. No, you are not allowed to do. You can't make big scary war machine monsters. You can't do genetic tampering that might have laws against it in the UW. This planet's okay because it's not in the UW.
Semi-peaceful, lawless society.
Yeah, and the corporations got along pretty well. I mean, they had some altercations between themselves, you know, but it's all paperwork. I mean, it's all corporation stuff. There was no gunfire or anything like that. Until one day,
dun, dun, dun.
The corporations got word that the UW was having problems. We don't know exactly what those problems were. Whatever they were, it was going to cause some major destabilization. In fact, the UW was about ready to fall apart. It was on the teetering edge of collapse. And so the megacorps say, well, there's going to be a power vacuum very soon, so we need to pull up roots.
Consolidate.
We need to consolidate our forces elsewhere and get our power and our money and our influence to where it's going to matter. So all of the bigwigs on the planet, the people in the know with the money and the spaceships,
quietly, quickly got on their ships and left.
And left. They get on their ship. They say goodbye to the people that matter. Or rather, they say goodbye to their servants and say, we'll see you in a couple of days, which is not true. And so they get on these ships and they start leaving in a big way. They start taking off off of this planet. And the masses quickly realize that they are being left behind. Mm-hmm. And so they start, you know, pushing towards these leftover, the last few shuttles to leave are at the sites of their starports are riots, and you know regular soldier or regular people are getting fired on by, you know, corporate soldiers, you know, because there's no room.
There's a little touch of Blade Runner in this, where anyone left on the planet is the one, are those who didn't have the influence to get off when the getting was good.
Yeah, what that did leave, though, is that because a lot of the people on this planet were corporate workers in some way, because all the bigwigs, the scientists, the upper management folk got off, that left a lot of the blue collar workers, the middle of the line technicians, that left those guys behind on a planet that initially they just now kind of inherited.
Now, before this even happened, because the fact that the planet was so hostile, the corporation was regularly sending in things like medicine, food.
Because that stuff wasn't there.
So now that the corporation has pulled out, there is no more food coming. There is no more medicine coming. There is no more nothing.
Yeah. So it creates an immediate need for, well, conflict, unfortunately.
People start fighting for room. They start fighting for food, fighting for survival, fighting for, you know, shelter from the horrible
acid rain. Becomes a post-apocalyptic scenario without any apocalypse having to happen.
The planet was an apocalypse to start with. They were just staving it off with all the stuff the UW was sending them. The corporations were shipping in all these resources and supplies.
So any of those buildings or structures that generate clean air, more food, anything like that becomes a power point and everyone's fighting.
Mm-hmm. Until eventually those break down because there's no replacement parts. You know, if the chemical they use to create, to filter out the horrible, you know, pollution is only made off-world, eventually that chemical runs out, and those filters stop working.
And you die or adapt.
You die or adapt. And that's exactly what happened.
And this is the world that they're left in.
This is the world that they're left in. And
moving on up.
Society... It imploded. The human society fell into utter chaos. A new dark age emerged.
Ooh.
And, so you have tribes of people, basically the people that could hold up in individual areas. They ganged together to survive, or they didn't. They just didn't make it. And, you know, millions died off. You know, died off, got killed, whatnot. And after a while, there was a group of people that got together and said, "We will die. We will fall apart if we don't find a way to get together and make this happen." And they recreated the original city, which is Port City. I know that is, you know, because it was a starport. Now it's just a giant, you know, walled town of people. They got together and they reforged the old city and created a set of laws for people to live within there, rationing of food, you know, creating an actual real government again. But the only way to do that was to give everyone something to believe in again. And so they found old writings, old texts, old history, about religion, about, you know, the gods of old man, you know, to kind of cement everyone back together again. And that created what they have now become known as the Forsaken. The Forsaken is in they because they were left behind by their you know, by the corporations that brought them here. Now, this is several generations after that has happened.
So that means that much of the technology that's been left behind is a mystery for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
So it really is like an old dark age where you have
Absolutely.
People passing down a trade.
Individual trades, absolutely. And, you know, so you're guys who may still have some medical knowledge, you know, people who you passed on first aid skills from, you know, father to son to daughter to sister's brother, you know, who you taught who you could over time because, you know, obviously no one, there's no interwebs for you to go and, you know, check to see what Google says about it. They, you know, your medical knowledge is really almost like pre-Victorian.
So science reverts to almost like magic again, where we don't know how it works. We know that this works and we can keep doing it.
Or at least it's magic to anyone who hasn't been trained on it.
Yeah, the people who know how it works may be able to like, well, no, it's, you know, it works this way. But everyone else around it sees this, you know, sees this awesome, uniquely weird thing.
Right.
And that makes that person important to the tribe or the city or village or wherever they're from.
But even some of the people who know how it works don't know necessarily why it works.
Yeah,
there's it's not that full knowledge base.
It's not necessarily the why of it. It's just that if I do this, it will
exactly
work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's theocracy. Basically,
this theocracy
is
created, and it's actually headed up by the Prevailer Council. The Prevailers. The Prevailer Council kind of runs the city, runs Port City, runs the Forsaken as an entity, and I don't want to say they use God.
Hold on one second.
Oh, Brad. Okay. Chris is having some technical issues.
It's easier that way.
Chris is cranking it tight and
Chris
adjusting
his
pole.
His pole. Oh, the look. The look that you listeners can't see.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
All right, so.
So the Forsaken are basically a theocratic organization that are surviving and actually kind of thriving at this point because they have real law. They've got, you know, law in place and they don't kill each other. You know, they're following effectively commandments. You
so
know, they're
this
not
is practically a golden age.
In comparison, they've reached an awesome place, with one exception is they have been relying very heavily on the science of grafting. Grafting is the addition of mechanical parts to a living creature. Kind of like cybernetics, except not really computer driven. You know, instead of having phalanges and meaty fingers, you have hinges and, you know, bioelectrically powered, you know, metal.
Pneumatic limbs.
In an effort, because maybe the metal worker has iron, you know, has metal hands now. So he can handle hot metal. It just makes it easier for him. Or maybe he's stronger or whatnot.
Okay.
At the very least, maybe it's to replace a terrible injury so that he's back and functioning within society.
Except somewhere along the line, the Prevailer Council makes a decision that they are becoming too reliant on grafting to survive. This is where the line is blurred between, you know, God's law and the Prevailer's ideas.
Okay.
They make the decision that grafting can only be used on animals. Humans can no longer rely on it anymore. This causes kind of an uproar in the city because there's a lot of people out there that were using grafting not only to get by but to excel, you know, to become more important in their field because they were better than the next guy because they've had this grafting done. One individual, a fabulously courageous, charismatic, my faction.
I was going to say, this is a bias
this is
or
skewed.
Anything.
This is skewed. No, a gentleman comes forward named Johan, and Johan is a leader of the people, and a leader of some people, and he says, grafting is not only, you know, not only the reason why we're surviving, but, you know, it's really kind of, it needs to be even more focused on. We need to look deeper into grafting because maybe we can stop just surviving and we can start expanding. We can start winning.
The way you explained it earlier, I thought really hit it on the head when you were talking with us before the recording, which was those opposed to it claim that if you are, they were created in God's image, and grafting goes against that. Versus what he said, which was, we have the tools to improve ourselves,
which was also a gift from God. Why aren't we using this gift?
So it's letter. It's forms of interpretation.
Yeah, and the Prevailer Council told Johann that he needed to stop. You know, he's going against the grain. And Johann effectively told them that, no, he's not going to stop. And he's got these, you know, hundreds of followers that are loyal to him. And he's going to stick it out. And they excommunicated him and kicked him out. They said, well, if you feel that way, you are going to go against the way we think, be gone with you.
And it sounds like an exile in this world is fairly fatal.
It could be a suicide. Okay. I mean, it could be a death sentence. I mean, there are outposts out there. There are other buildings and other corporations, because the corporations had their own territories. You know, so there are other cities out there, but this is the only one that seems to have survived.
So the long shot is you look for something else that somebody built and abandoned, and hope for the best.
Yeah. And hope that you don't get attacked by, you know, alien forces or the outcasts, which are people who decided Port City was a bad idea from the beginning, and they kind of Mad Max it out in the wastelands.
So there are people out there.
Correct. And that's actually one of the factions of the game, are the outcasts.
Ah.
Non-forsaken humans that raid, pillage, and they still trade. They do some caravan trading with the city. But there is no question that they are not... They don't follow the Port City Way. They don't follow the Prevailer Council. So, but they're also not allowed in.
So right now we know that there are people out there known as the outcasts. But we're also aware of the Forsaken, which sounds like the closest thing we have to organized regular society.
Correct.
But now you've just introduced Johann and his followers. What happens to them?
Johann and his followers leave the city and venture out into the wastes in order to find their way. Continually practicing grafting along the way because, well, they aren't following the laws anymore.
Well, they are. They just
They're following their own laws now. Johann is labeled a heretic. In fact, he is called the heretic saint. His followers still call him a saint, despite the Prevailer Council excommunicating him.
Well, it's a question of beliefs, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in his travels, he runs into one of the old fort outposts, Fort Retribution. Which is an old chemical plant in the middle of nowhere, where a group of humans held up several generations ago, and because, again, like you had said, you know, technology is out, and you don't know how to read cyanoacrylate phentamine thingamabob on the side of a barrel, so the only way to find out what it does is open it up.
Yep.
And
take a taste.
Hey, this looks like food. Oh, it's not food, it's death.
This is making my tongue melt.
Yeah, well... Over several generations, most of them died, and some of them survived. And those who survived, some of them mutated. And some of them mutated big, strong, ugly, or with psychic abilities.
So this was what you would categorize as almost like one of the outcast tribes?
They would have been one of the outcasts, but now at this point, they have kind of mutated to the point where they're their own thing. They're their own tribe.
Okay.
And they are the Skarrd. S-K-A-R-R-D. Skarrd. The Skarrd are almost not human anymore at this point.
The mutations have been that heavy from the chemicals.
They look human-ish, but a lot of them are much bigger. You know, 8 feet tall, 10 feet tall. They're big. They're brutal.
If I could use a video game term. Fallout 3. These are the super mutants.
No, the super mutants actually exist in the Outcast faction. They are called Brutes.
Oh, okay.
And those guys are 12 feet tall, and they were genetically modified back in the day to be laborers. I mean, they are super mutants.
Oh, they are out there. Okay.
Yeah, the Outcast faction is the Fallout faction, if you want to call it that way.
So these are just twisted humans.
These are just
humans.
Humans that are bigger, and they're at this point, their own kind of a separate species.
All right.
And the tribe collectively is called the Skarrd. They also, because of, well, you live in the middle of nowhere and there's nothing to eat, they have since turned to cannibalism.
So the weak die.
The weak die and they're used to fuel the rest of the strong. The rest of the tribe to make it strong, I should say. Well, Johann runs into these guys and they see this, you know, pilgrimage of sad and weary travelers.
Hey, food delivery.
Yeah, and the tribal father kind of comes forward and says, hey, what are you doing? You're in our territory, and now you're lunch. And Johan explains that, well, he wants to enter Fort Retribution. He wants to come here, and he wants to, you know, bring the true word of God, his word of God, to them. You know, let's join forces. And the tribal father of the Scarred laughs at him and is like, you're weak, you're broken, you're a bloody mess. You're just going to be food. And Johan, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing here. The story's in the Forceless book, and it's awesome. Johan basically tells him that, you know, what do I need to do to prove that we are that my word and my way is stronger than yours?
So they had a parlay, but the parlay was fairly one-sided as far as the Scarred were concerned. You're here. You're doomed. You got one chance.
Yeah. And the tribal father says, well, go ahead and, you pick your champion and I'm going to pick mine. And you got one chance. And he sends forth one of his big, brutal, savage cannibal warriors and goes running towards Johan, who is this, at this point, he looks broken. He looks beaten. He's bloody from all over. And as soon as that big warrior gets remotely close to Johan opens up like a Swiss Army knife because he's so heavily grafted at this point that he has secret weapons on secret weapons, and he pulls out his katanas and his grafted weapons and turns this guy into meat paste. This champion just is done. And the Scarred have not seen grafting to this degree because it's been, you know, hundreds of years since he's
probably forgotten.
It's a long forgotten science as far as they're concerned. and Johan has just proved not only is it not forgotten, but he's got this in spades. And
he might be the best example of it on the planet.
Absolutely. And they shake hands. You've proven your point. You are powerful enough to hang with us, and you've got stuff that you can bring to the table.
You may have sanctuary in my tribe.
And so Johan and his guys come in, and they join the Scarred tribe, and over the course of a generation or so, kind of take control of a big chunk of them.
This is it's sort of a page from the Paul Muad'Dib story.
Paul Muad'Dib.
You may have sanctuary in my tribe.
And so he has now taken control of a big chunk of the Scarred, and he has his own force list within the Scarred. Johan and a bunch of Scarred forces and some Forsaken troops.
So Johan is in charge, but now he's effectively part of the Scarred.
He is now effectively part of the Scarred. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And the Scarred is split up into several different mini tribes called cults.
But do they work in tandem?
They can. Yeah, they work together. Okay. They're collectively all part of the Scarred. They might have some argumentative differences, but
it rarely comes to blows, for example.
Yeah, no reason to.
I mean, so when there are differences, it's usually resolved like,
well, it's not amicably, obviously, because they're the Scarred. So I'm going to send a champion forward. You're
so we're talking
send
about
champion.
We're talking about duels as opposed to armies.
Yeah, you're probably going to. I mean, you're still going to have people. If you want to play Scarred on Scarred, you can. There was an argument that couldn't be settled. But as far as like narratively, you're probably going to see one champion step forward, another champion step forward, and the one that murders the other
wins
the decision.
That's apparently the innocent one. The other was the guilty.
Kind of. Yeah. Okay. Very an extremely Darwinian view on things.
Okay. Interesting. So we've got effectively a viewpoint for three different factions now. So the Forsaken are back in Port City, and Fort Retribution is
Fort Retribution is where the Scarred are collectively based out of.
Well,
they have since split and grown outside of the fort, but that's really the home base.
And then the outcast can be found nearly anywhere that isn't one of those two cities,
anywhere that they can survive. They're okay. Probably going to be relatively close to another settlement because they've got to be able to survive in some way.
Is that by definition an unorganized faction, or do they have quiet organization?
They have a Mad Max style organization. There's going to be the strongest in an area.
Two men enter, one man leaves.
the strongest and most intelligent man in the area.
Thunderdome
or woman?
That's the name of it. I couldn't remember the name of the town.
Thunderdome
though. was the name of the town. Thunderdome or just
Bartertown?
Bartertown.
They were in the yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry,
methane cometh.
It's a blast.
I just remember the one line: "Methane cometh from pig."
I'm sorry to do that.
Hey, no, you know what? A Mad Max reference is perfect here. The outcasts have an extremely Mad Max feel, and if you're a video game fan, they have an extremely Fallout feel because they have super mutants.
Cool.
That fight with concrete blocks.
So you were talking about, so the outcasts have the super mutants.
They've got the super mutants.
any other factions that are out there that are going to go against Johann or the Forsaken or the Outcasts?
Well, everyone kind of runs into each other because, again, on this world, resources are key. Right. You know, if you can find a place that's not, you know, filled with acid lakes and, you know, fire that shoots out of the ground from time to time, you're probably going to settle there. Hey, look, it's stable ground.
This place won't kill me tonight.
This place won't kill me for the next couple of days, so we'll set our tents up here.
If I sleep here, I'll wake up.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great way of putting it. And the permanent settlements are the places where, you know, enough of these people have gotten together, or the leftovers of the old civilization that are rock steady and held up enough that they can maintain a common population. But Port City is still the largest of all of these.
Now, you mentioned a couple of times in passing that when this original, was it EU or UE? The
UW.
UW. They did run into aliens. And then you second mentioned that these tribes, when they were scattering out there, that if they were exiled, they're at risk of being killed by aliens. So apparently they're out there. You want to go into detail?
They are out there. In fact, one of the main factions is an alien faction, but only kind of in generality. Because the Dragiri, which is the alien race in Dark Age, they technically are even alien to this world. Several thousand years before humans ever set foot on Q4B, the Dragiri came to this planet. The Dragiri set up shop and they survived. About 2,000 years before humans got here, they suffered their own cataclysm. A giant meteor hit the planet and, you know, kind of dinosaur killing event sort of thing. And most of them were they were driven underground to survive.
Okay.
You know, the surface was even worse than it is now. They remained on the planet.
Okay.
They just went under the planet. They couldn't go topside. And while they were underground, they worked out their own little things and their own differences and created a caste-based system.
Well, it sounds like they had to reorganize in the same way as...
sounds like THX 1138.
Kinda.
That's right. For those who don't know, that's Lucas's first movie that sort of alludes to a completely underground society.
Yeah. If you don't know what's wrong with you, if you're listening to this and you're that kind of a geek and you haven't seen Lucas's first film, get to work.
So the Dragiri have their own little society where they've got what's called slaves and trueborn. Slaves are diminutive little Dragiri, shorter than a man, kind of hunched over. They got weird chicken legs. and they do all of the physical labor. If you want to read further back into their story, the roles were actually originally reversed before the meteor hit the planet. The little dudes were in charge.
Aha.
So brain versus brawn, but the moment society is no longer intellectually based, but rather survival based, the strong will take over.
The strong took over and put the slaves into their place. And over the last 1,000 years, the slaves have now... They're now genetically predisposed to be in that place. They are just there. You know, they wake up and go, I'm a slave. I get to move things today. Excellent. I hope I'm not beaten. You know, I mean, like, that's just, it's their life.
Zug zug.
Yeah, exactly. and the trueborn are giants. I mean, they are...
Compared to humans,
they are 15, 18 feet tall. They're massive. And it's reflected by the size of their models in the game. They're huge and beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're pretty all right.
They were the first ones to catch my eye, actually. That was the first. I looked at that. Ooh, I want to do that. But then I saw the Saints.
No, I totally want to play the monster guys.
They're pretty.
Yeah. No, I did. When I looked at the models, the first ones that caught my eye were those ice creatures. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, those kind of remind me a little bit of my Rasputina stuff from Malifaux. I really like that. And then I stopped and I looked through the Saints, and the Charlie Church in me went over and said, dude, Saints with guns, that's kind of cool in my book.
Sort of a Judge Dredd sort of feel to it.
Nuns with guns or things like that. Yeah, I liked it. I liked it a lot.
The Dragiri have recently suffered their own internal conflicts because after the cataclysm, after everything, you know, went to hell in a handbasket, eventually they started venturing out onto the surface again. They realized, you know, maybe things aren't so bad. Oh, am I not?
There you go.
Oh, I was leaning.
Beautiful.
Okay. They start venturing at, you know, sticking their heads out of hidey holes and finding out that it sucks on the surface, but at least they can go. and they recreate a new society. They recreate their society, and it's built into various elemental castes, earth, wind, water, fire, and shadow.
I hate shadow.
And they...
Mind Razor.
Wrong shadow.
Oh, sorry.
they basically kind of run their own world, a very honor-bound system. It almost feels a little samurai-ish. The Trueborn are very, very honorable. Their slaves are to deal all with the menial tasks. You know, they do all of the almost like serfs in like feudal Japan.
Okay.
The Trueborn are, I don't want to say posh, but they don't have to really do anything. It's not their job. The slaves do all the work, so they get a chance to focus on what matters to them.
Well, how did this completely alien and unusual sounding society make their way back to the planet in question?
Well, no, they never left.
Oh, they're still there. They were underground at the time that humans showed up. Is that correct?
No, they popped up out of the ground like 1,000 years before people got here. This is all prehistory.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah, this is all prehistory.
Okay.
And then somewhere along the lines, the fire cast, the fire cast and the water cast have an understandable difference of opinion as to who should run the show. So the fire wins out. They end up beating the water cast and kicking them to the curb. So fire is in charge of the Jugiri lands, which are far, 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 far away from where humans are.
Okay.
But the water cast leaves to go lick its wounds.
Leaves the planet?
No, leaves the continent, the area where the Jugiri live on the planet.
The planet's big enough and difficult to navigate enough where people can be anywhere, and you can't just sense them.
Yeah, correct. You don't have the technology. Maybe they may have known something was out there a long time ago, back when technology was still awesome. But honestly, they were so self-absorbed in their own corporate needs and whatnot, they probably never cared.
We're not in Star Trek land. If you don't have a magic device that helps you locate people, you could just walk away and they'll never find you.
Absolutely.
So in this case, there's an alien culture out there and we'll never know.
Yeah, they don't know it exists. So the water cast goes away to, is beaten and decides eventually they are going to need to, you know, kick it back into gear and take back their rightful spot. So they decide to quite literally harden up and become more militant and more powerful than you could possibly imagine. And they transform themselves into the ice cast.
Literally hardening.
Literally hardening themselves, their ideology, and their shamanic beliefs.
So in this case, their metaphor is also literal.
Yeah, yes. They turn themselves into the ice cast. And the ice cast is now in human lands, because they're far, far away from the Jagiri lands, so now they're in the same area as Port City and Fort Retribution, and they're in the same vicinity.
Okay.
Relatively speaking, where they are trying to rebuild themselves to former glory. So eventually they can go back and retake their homeland.
Cool.
And win the day.
Are those all the factions we've got now?
There is only one other.
Well, the quick question is, supposed to be 1,000 years ago. So how have humans and Dragiri met?
You expand where there are resources. You go to where resources may be, and...
So at this point, humans in the act of spreading out to try and survive on this planet have suddenly come across...
They have run into... There's actually in the Forceless book, there's a really cool story about one of the Forsaken Scouts running into her first Dragiri, and it's a terrifying experience for her.
Do we have some sort of, like, I don't know, diplomatic relations with them, or are they just these monsters that are out there?
From the Forsaken's point of view, they are simply godless demons of the wasteland.
Okay.
From the Dragiri point of view, it's these strange, weak, squishy...
A race of slaves.
There's a race of potential slaves out there that, strangely enough, have these unfortunate devices that can hurt us. And that would be like guns and things, because the Jagiri don't have that kind of science. Their science is far more shamanic, and it all revolves around these crystals that they can infuse with energy.
Okay.
And so the idea of like a moving part gun is not only foreign, you know, like their moving part equipment, the Trueborn that have been dishonored are given ballista to fire because they're not good enough to get up in close combat and deal with things honorably. So they're given these gigantic like bolt thrower ballistas, and that's soul splitters. That's what they are.
Okay, coward. You get a gun because you're a coward. Coward.
Exactly. You're a 15-foot tall coward. Coward.
Ah, I see.
So they're still, you know, utterly badass from a human standpoint, but to another Jagiri, oh, you poor thing. You have to carry this giant crossbow.
You got a gun.
But even then, that's the extent of their technology, as far as, you know, what we view as science and technology.
Why build a gun when your claws do better?
Yeah. You know, so your idea of your gun is all these crazy moving parts to fire something hard that goes through someone. Or I have this thing that has two moving parts and does the exact same thing and possibly better. Why am I doing anything else? The Jagiri just don't have that desire. Focus on honor rather than advancement.
Well, sort of the other version of necessity is the mother of invention.
All the big, tough guy, super tough guy races are always the guys. It's your Klingons focus on their honor system. You got your. It's always the big brute guy that the whole society is based around the honor
because
of the fighting.
Because if you have a society of brutes and no one has any honor, you will have a lawless society of anarchists. So if you include honor, that means that in a group where they all think they're alphas, there will be some organization. It makes sense.
And oh, totally. That's kind of a rhetorical question. I was just thinking about it. It always seems to be that there's always that character in these.
Oh yeah.
The
yeah,
stereotype
definitely.
Seems to hold true though. It's like, okay, oh, yeah. Well, if you all think you're alphas, no one's the alpha.
Exactly.
Which is awesome because also in the game, for when you build a Jagiri force,
uh-huh.
You must have three slave models for every True Blood model in your force.
Yeah, I totally want to play these guys.
You must bring them.
I don't know which cast I'm going to play, but that's my army.
Yeah.
That was easy.
that's easy.
That was easy. Done.
Well, and, okay, so we have one more?
We have one more existing current faction.
Okay.
Derived from humans, if I remember.
Sort of, kind of. There was a corporation during the height of the corporation awesomeness that came to this planet and focused on bioengineered weapons, bioweapons, viruses and
death gel.
viruses and death gel. But also to creating bioweapons. Like,
it's a floor wax. It's a dessert topping. You're both right.
What the hell?
I don't even know. New new shimmer is delicious. And just look at that shine.
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
It's from an old Saturday Night Live. That's great bass.
Was that before I was born?
Yes,
sure.
That was before
oh,
you were born.
Shut
it. Is there. Oh.
How old are you?
My name's Brad Steele. I was born last week. I love my games.
I'm only four.
I'm 34.
I'm 34. Shut up. I'm a man,
so you're
okay?
You're 5 years younger than me. don't get snippy.
Don't get cocky, kid.
Yeah. You'll find yourself floating home.
Yay.
So
I don't want to float home. I like to float.
We all
float
down
here. I'm only four.
I'm sad because I'm flying. All right, so screw
gravity. So this other company that makes all these bioweapons, they created life forms. They basically used DNA of various things and, you know, did some hankering and some alteration and whatnot and created all kinds of weapon types or organisms that would be, you know, useful to drop on a planet, you know, fire and forget missiles that have legs. You know, like
pharmacological weapons.
Oh. You just stroked my verbalism.
Go.
I love it.
I like words.
Words.
Vocabulophile. So Dave just
So this company made a whole bunch of
they
nasty
made a
business.
Mess of really cool critters, and including they even made a critter who's kind of designed to make other critters. You know, so, the kind of thing that you would drop on an enemy.
So we're talking about not more than just pharmacological. We're talking about bioengineered,
yeah,
like living
entities.
Okay.
That, you know, they tested and created and
so
put
chemical
in,
and
put in
biological warfare.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And they made one that whose design was to create more. It's a progenitor of other critters because you drop one of these onto your enemy's whatever, and given time, that's all that's going to be left.
A biobomb.
A biobomb.
Cool.
And here's the deal. If they managed to perfect this, the creation, they could also then make effectively, I want to use the term, but like an antidote. You know, something, you know, once your biobomb has run its course, then you drop the second biobomb and it eliminates the first biobomb, and now everything is awesome.
So the enemy's gone and you've got a place to be.
Yeah, that was the idea. Well, they created a lot of stuff and they made a lot of really cool things, and their base of operations, their actual like location is in a marshland, because they had a lot of you know, decent genetic material to work with in this marsh.
Okay.
Things that they could draw from, a lot of plants, animals. This was a good place for them.
So, like you said before, this planet was hostile, but at the same time, there was plentiful resources.
Absolutely.
And they went to where they needed to be.
Well, if you have a company that's based on trying to deal with biological things, you go to where there's the most biological resources to be had.
So it's
and
not
this
a dead
marsh,
planet, it's just a dangerous planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And so they go to this marsh where there's lots of biological life forms to deal with, including, effectively, you know, if you think about it, every planet that has life on it, originally there was some kind of primordial ooze. You know, there's some kind of primordial sludge.
Some sort of soup or stew.
You know, life soup. And this marsh had a life soup pool in it. And they kept, it was there. And
or
a
smoothie.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
A life smoothie. There was a genetic life smoothie, and they were able to use a lot of this stuff from there. Well, then the corporate recall happened, where they're like, okay, everybody off the planet. And there was some question as to what they should do with the life forms. Some people said, it doesn't matter. Who cares? They'll just die. We pull the plug and it's no big deal.
Sounds like they didn't, Brian.
They didn't die. In fact, they kind of got flushed down the drain. Bloosh, and ended up in the swamp with the primordial sludge.
This is sort of that New York myth of, you know, if we just drop the alligator down the sewers, I'm sure it'll die.
Yeah, and okay. Then you have like 9 awesome movies. You know, Crocodile 1, 2, and 3, Alligator 1 and 2. That's what happens. In this case, you get a faction.
Faction 1.
Faction 1. They are collectively called the Brood. They are the creations of the Broodmare, which is the critter I had mentioned that kind of links other critters together and creates others. It hit that genetic sludge in the swamp and thrives.
So give the listeners a chance to like sort of visualize, what is this army? What should they be expecting to see?
It is, if you're a 40K player, it's Tyranids that are far more humanoid.
So that means chitinous humans?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. There are some non-humanoid critters in it. There are the Broodhounds, which are not little, they're the size of small trucks. Dogs. They remind me a lot of the dogs from the demon dogs that Dana Barrett turned into in Ghostbusters.
Okay.
But they're all collectively part of the Brood, and the Brood is all collectively controlled by the Brood.
Oh, that was the character's name. I'm like, who's Dana Barrett? Oh, that's
Sigourney
Weaver. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never remembered her name except, yeah, Dana.
Get with the program, Venkman.
Dave, tell them about the Twinkie.
It's a big Twinkie.
Cats and dogs living together. Mass hysteria.
I love it. Loads of registered voters.
The walls in the 25th seat were bleeding. All right, so we're talking chitinous human beings. Any sort of... almost like the Coraline from Void.
Yeah, I do remember that game. I did some playtesting and fiction rules, or fiction, some fan fiction for them that got published.
Wow, okay.
Is it dirty fan fiction stuff?
No, regular fan fiction. None of that weird stuff.
I was just asking.
Not that I think that stuff is weird. If you're a writer out there and you're writing fan fiction, keep writing. Eventually someone might find you and tell you to not do weird, porny things.
But at least you've been found.
But at least you've been found. Do what you can.
So is that where I should get my start?
Let your freak flag fly and then just put it away when you have a paycheck. So where was I going with this?
All right, so we were talking about the final faction is the Brood.
The Brood.
And you're describing them, so their primary location's in a swamp.
The Black Marsh, yeah. They are centered out of this like deep sludgy marshland.
So this is hard to get my mind around. Are they a sentient army?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because they're going off of their original genetic code, what they were created to do, and that was to expand and evolve.
Not necessarily to destroy?
Some of them are.
So they are a society. I mean, they
have their own weird hive mind.
Oh, I was so going to ask. They have the hive mind with the broodmare?
Their whole goal is to prosper.
If they could be left alone forever, they would. The problem is that, you know, again, pass up generations, the humans will eventually, they see on the horizon, one of their scouts sees this cool place that has trees. Trees mean water. Water means life. So they go towards the Black Marsh, and, oh, dear God, this thing is eating me. And so
there's only so many places on the Petri dish to expand before you got to fight the other bacteria.
Well, or more importantly.
Ooh, nice analogy.
That is a good analogy. Yeah. Or, more importantly, when the broodmare gets a taste of there are humans around, and they remember humans. Humans are where all genetic evolution in the lab came from.
Can they use the genetic material from humans to... Okay, there we go.
Do they remember humans in a nice way or a bad way? Like, these were the people experimenting
on
us?
An unbelievably neutral way.
Okay.
A factual way. They're sentient, but they're more sentient than animals. The story in
this
the Force
is so cool.
The story for the because every Force List entry in the Force List book has a kind of a narrative story in the beginning of it. The one in the beginning of the brood section is one of my favorites because of how it's written. It's written from the point of one of their like scouting creatures called a gazelle. It's a bipedal, like 8 foot tall bipedal chick with lashing tentacle head thing.
Okay.
The brood, you know, they realize there are humans out there, and that means more genetic complexity. There's more stuff out there. There's more base materials to use.
That's food.
And food, and, you know, this is the way it is. So they effectively, humans stirred up the hornet's nest, and now the brood are...
They're active because they realize the potential of what humanity could be for them.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a new frontier, and it activated biological imperatives that are there.
Cool.
Very cool. Well, are we ready?
And they've got a character named Mean Jellybean. How can you go wrong with that?
I love it.
Well, should we take ourselves a quick break and could jump right back in and start talking about the game mechanics itself?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll be right back.
Oi! You listening to... Snorty? Snorty, what's this music? This? No, No, I'm not doing it. Now, you want to play some airy-fairy music? You get an elf to do your promotions. I'm not saying nothing about no GarageHammer.net for those two idiot manlings with this music playing in the background. Now go find me something better, or they can go GarageHammer.nothing. No, I'm not talking about GarageHammer.net until they change the music, so shut it!
And we are back. Okay, so now to get started with this, there's two books right now. There's the main rule book, Dark Age Apocalypse.
Core rules.
And then there's the Force...
The Force Lists.
Force Lists. Now, the Force List book is really big and thick. It's got a lot of fluff. It's got all the different characters, all the different models, all the different...
It has rules and fluff for everything currently available in the Dark Age line.
So there's the one book of rules and then the one book for every faction, every army, every whatever you want to call it. It's one big army book for everything.
Correct.
All right. And how many factions did we say there are?
Forsaken, Outcast, Scarred, the Dragiri. Is that what they're called, Dragiri?
The Dragiri, yeah.
And then Brood?
And then the Brood. So there are currently five factions.
Okay.
Each individual faction has sub-partitions that you can draw from.
Okay.
So does that mean then I can play a Dragiri faction, you can play a Dragiri faction, we can effectively have two completely different armies?
Absolutely.
Okay. That are almost opposed. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, if we also have models that we could share.
So we start out, okay, but you've got your main faction.
Yes.
And each faction has universal models that no matter...
Correct.
That can go to any... Just if you play this faction, you could take these models.
Correct.
But then you also have what you call your force lists.
Correct.
Now, how do these differentiate?
Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to introduce, since many of our listeners are Warhammer-centric, I'm going to try and use an analogy. So it would be like saying that anyone can use the core models, but if you choose a specific faction, only you can use these special models.
Yeah, there okay. you go. Okay. No, that's actually a really good analogy.
Okay, well, there we go.
Awesome. Mm.
But so then you can choose. So you choose a faction, and then even more to the point, you choose a force.
A force list within the faction. Now you could just play the faction and just use generic models. If you wanted to, and there's nothing wrong with that.
And the starter boxes are pretty much that.
The starter boxes are all generic models. You're not going to find any forceless specific stuff in the starter boxes.
So that's a good way to start. I mean, you want to, that they're aptly named. That's an excellent way to get what you need to get
Absolutely.
Going.
Okay. Absolutely.
You want to tell, what's the average retail for those?
I would say average between them would be $50.
$50 and you get how many miniatures?
That depends. The Scarred.
Average.
Well, it's there's no good average. I would say maybe six.
Six? Okay.
Because the Brood is only like five models, but they're all large base models. They're all huge.
Comparable to War Machine large.
Yeah.
Okay.
There, I would say that.
But points-wise, they're all, each box is around
roughly
300
points. Yeah.
Which is a good start, because you had eight models,
mm-hmm.
and I had six.
That's a pretty,
correct.
That's a
and
pretty,
I actually had 5 points
pretty
more
affordable
than
deal.
You.
That's, yeah. That's, yeah. That's a good price.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, so the main rule book, which you don't necessarily need the force book to play.
No.
The main rule book's about $20, I think, was it?
It is $19.99.
I believe so.
So $20 for that, and then you buy your starter box.
Buy your starter box. The starter box will come with the actual unit cards with them.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't have the unit cards, or if you have access to Dark Age models, because remember, Dark Age Apocalypse is actually kind of a reboot of the original Dark Age game.
Okay.
So this is a second edition of sort.
Yeah. Okay. The original Dark Age game was actually released 1 week before the original War Machine back in 2002.
This might be a silly question.
Yes.
It is internationally available?
Yeah. Oh, you can, I believe so. Okay. I know Cool Mini will sell to you out there. So.
Okay.
Okay. I firmly believe so.
But only certain Cool Mini retailers in certain areas of the world can only sell in those certain areas because of
that
smart
guy.
Well, only about half of our listeners are from the United States.
Gotcha.
So
we're international, baby. We're global.
Gav, I'm so sorry. I won't let him do it again.
What?
Nothing.
No, dude, I like it. Okay, so you get your faction. And now what delineates the different force lists? Is there like is it picking a like a leader like
it's, it is depending on each individual faction, the force list can be in the Jaegiri, it's the two casts. The two available casts.
And that would be currently ice and
air. And the air cast are all a bunch of flexy ninja female Jaegiri, and they have got some of the coolest bendy models. They're
kind of
amazing.
This game does not shy away from the naked,
the risque
models. Yes.
Well, because the entire Dark Age originally, you know, 9 years ago, the original Dark Age game, the world, was based solely off of Brahm's art. The artist Brahm, who is amazing.
Win, 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 win.
Yes. Basically, they came to Brahm and said, "You've got this world in your head that you put out in your art. And we want to make a game based off of that world in your head." And he was like, "I don't think you can." And so they kind of stepped away, made a game set, and came towards him and came back with him and showed, "This is what we got going. And this is the story we've come up with. Because, you know, he'd already kind of told a story with his pictures, but it had never been written down.
Right.
They created more of a story and then came back to him and said, "This is what we came up with by what you've drawn.
Do you like it?
Do you like it?" And he goes, "Tell me more." And that was the start of Dark Age. That was how the Dark Age game line began.
Cool.
There's actually a really cool story in the front of the core rule book that has that story.
Yeah, I read that story.
Okay.
Yeah, that was really, I liked it. But so let's say now my particular faction that I really like are the
Forsaken.
The Forsaken. I was, like I said to Christopher, the ice models, I was really drawn to them really quickly. But then I saw the Saints. And I was like, "Oh, I really kind of like these a
They're
lot.
They're pretty sharp,
and they often go marching in."
And so, but so if
God.
But so if you pick up the Forsaken, I'm trying to trudge this along here. If I pick up the Forsaken's faction,
okay,
the force list will be broken down by the different saints.
The different saints. So there are currently four saints.
To make an analogy, if I may,
okay,
a War Machine. Analogy, okay. And I'm no, everyone knows I have no War Machine aficionado, but there's Trollbloods, which would be, say, a faction.
Okay.
And then there are the different casters, which, I mean, and they're, obviously they could pick from anything, but each caster would have a sort of different way of style of play, a different feel.
The difference would be is that if the casters had units that only they could bring.
Imagine if you played Dark Elves and you chose to only play a Kainite army versus only...
Well, no, I mean, I get it. I just want to make sure that the listeners get it. So but when you break into these force lists, like the model that I liked was Saint Mark, which you were so kind and generous as to bring me a Saint Mark model. So there is.
Hey, I want to play Dragiri.
there is the faction for the Forsaken, and then the force list under Saint Mark has certain models that you can only take if you're playing with Saint Mark. And there's a Universalist.
Not necessarily if he's present. You don't have to have the Saint present for you to use his force list.
Okay.
You can say, I am a Forsaken force list of Saint Mark, and then have a bunch of Saint Mark's forces, and you leave him home because he's 135 points.
Well, and which I also like because, let's face it, Saint Mark is not going to show up for every mission that his people go on.
I'm sure he has hundreds and thousands of hundreds or thousands of followers that he can send on missions, and that's exactly what that would be.
Which is one of the things I like, because at least fluff-wise in this game, it's like...
These are his people. He doesn't have to be at every battle.
Well, exactly. It kind of like when you don't have to have... who am I thinking? What's his name? Mephiston doesn't have to show up at every little skirmish.
Yes.
You can have a Mephistani list, a list based off of this guy and his followers, without having him show up at every little skirmish.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I like that.
Every game, done on turn one.
but that's what I'm saying is, I mean, there's a lot of elements of this game that I really like. Now that we're kind of moving out of the fluff and sort of into the game, and we got to play the one game, and I actually had a really good time, partially because Brian and I had been talking a lot before he came out today, and he knew I liked the Forsaken, so he actually brought a crew for me to play that would be part of the ones that I actually liked and wanted to get a feel for.
Yeah,
and I was right, man. I really did. I kind of enjoyed how they worked.
He killed my Golob with a saw blade.
Yes, I did. I shot a big rotary saw disc
into one of my giant dudes, and he fell over dead.
You got to stop rolling 20s.
I'm very sorry.
Okay, so let's go ahead and talk. So let's talk about a basic turn.
Okay.
Now, the game runs 8 turns, and I guess before we get into the basic turn, we should talk about how we set the game up.
Okay,
well,
makes sense.
You build armies using points just like Fantasy or 40K or just about any other miniature game.
Every activation or activatable squad or individual has a point value.
Okay.
But more importantly, there is a setup on every unit will have. You can have so many of this. You know how, and for all you Warhammer centric folk out there, how you have to have X number of core percentage units or things like that. It doesn't work that way in this. It's Dark Age. Every individual type of troop or individual type of troop. Okay. That made sense in my head. I hope it made sense to you guys.
It made sense.
I gotcha.
It will say how many of that type of thing you can take per X number of points. Normally, it's within 500 or 1,000 points.
On the actual card, there's 3 little circles in kind of near the bottom. One is the size of the base.
The size of the model.
Or the size of the model, sorry. Yeah. The size of the model, which run from tiny, small,
tiny,
medium.
Tiny, small, medium, large, huge.
Okay, so there's 5 model sizes. Then there will be another picture with, it looks like a little meeple on it. And if the guy is an individual, meaning he's just the one guy, then it'll just have a little picture of that.
Yeah, it'll just...
Now, if he could be...
I don't even know what a meeple is.
You played Carcassonne?
Yeah.
Those little pegs that look like little people pegs?
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, the meeples.
I call those gaming pawns. I've never heard the term meeple. It's hilarious.
I've heard it on D6G a lot when you play all these different games where they've got, I guess, the Agricola and stuff. They've got the little meeples. The little
meeple.
So... The game has certain limitations that they set up. Each squad or each individual will have limitations that it will tell you up front.
Right. Well, yeah, the one card I picked up, the squad, it said it had a little picture and it said 2 to 6. So I know my squad size for that. It's a unit.
It's a squad of
2 to 6 units because each model is a unit.
Right.
So the squad is 2 to 6. And then next to it is one more picture. And there was a little circle and it said 1,000 in it. So I knew it was I could have one of these for every 1,000 points in the game. Some, let's say, 500. Some have an infinity sign. You can take as many as you feel like.
So the generics are generally going to be pretty open list, while the specific ones per force rather than per faction, you might be more limited because they're more specialized?
Yeah, kind of. And then there's also, you might find one that has an asterisk there, and that means there's something special. Either they're unique, in the case of the Saints, has an asterisk there. You're only ever allowed to have one, ever.
There's only going to be one Saint mark. What, special characters.
What we call special characters, but what this game calls...
unique individuals.
Okay.
Or, in the case of my primary faction is the Scarred, they have lots of troops that you can only take if you have another dude, a specific type of guy, called a grafter. You can only have one squad of these guys if you have a grafter. You can only have one squad of these guys if you have a grafter. So they don't have a 1 for 1,000 or 1 for 500. They just have a little asterisk that says, depending on the game size, and then the grafter is the one that has the limitations as to how many points it takes to have one of him.
So you can have usually a grafter for every 1,000 points, I believe?
Yes, yes.
Now, if you have one grafter, if it says, like, you had a unit of harpies in your box that came with the Scarred.
Yes.
And you can have one unit of harpies per grafter.
Correct.
Now, if there's a different type of unit, you know, the Schmiebens, I'm just making stuff up.
The Electro Schmiebens.
The Scarred, for instance, the Scarred Abomination.
Now, Scarred Abomination is one
per every grafter.
For every grafter. Now, if you have one grafter, could you have a unit of Scarred Abominations and a unit of harpies?
Yes.
Because that doesn't break the limit of per grafter. So
correct.
There could be multiple units that need a grafter.
That rely on that grafter to be in the force list.
Well, that's just a game mechanic that allows you, you don't necessarily want to have to take this guy, but you must if you want to take these guys, which are much cooler.
Exactly, exactly.
So maintenance, or what is it called? Support.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. And so you make your list, and...
And the way that the force list system, we were talking about force lists, if you wanted to play Forsaken, and you said, I love St. Mark, but I really, really wish I could take some of St. Luke's arsenals, because they're amazing. You can do that if you play a game bigger than 1,000 points, because every 1,000 points, you can draw from a different force list.
And this is basically an ally system.
Kind of, yeah, as long as they're all from the same faction.
So if we're playing the faction's the same. Point yeah. game. If I'm paying a 1,500 point game, I have to have the first 1,000 all has to be legal for my St. Mark.
For whatever faction you've chosen, yes.
Right. Okay. Well, that's what I'm just choosing St. Mark. So then if I want to take St. Luke's, some of his guys, I got to have that first 1,000 have to be Mark.
Correct.
And then I can take the other 500 can be Luke.
From Luke.
Now, it doesn't have to be, I could take 1,100. I mean, as long as I've got the first 1,000.
Correct.
It's just. Okay, you have to have at least 1,000 in mark, and then if I go over, it's okay.
Well, and here's the deal. A lot of that 1,000 points, just because of how the individuals work,
right.
or the various squads and stuff work, it's going to be real hard to come up with 1,000 points from without taking generic forces. I mean, almost impossible, I would say.
So you're going to
end up bleeding into... You know, so saying 1,100 points of mark and 400 points of Luke is probably closer to taking 400 to 500 points of Mark's forces and 300 points of Luke's forces, and then
and
actually
the
like
the
1,200 points or you know, 900 points of my math is bad.
because the generics fall into either
they
camp.
They fall into either camp. So it's kind of some, it just depends on when you're writing up your list where
you have
decide
to, make sure,
to write
you just
them
have
down.
To make sure that 1,000 legally break into this guy's...
Exactly.
Okay, but
exactly.
It doesn't have to be an exactly... it has to be at least 1,000, but not stop at exactly 1,000.
Yeah, the only one... The only faction that kind of breaks that rule is the Brood.
Okay.
Because the Brood's force lists are extremely specific because everybody from that force list gets a particular trait.
Okay.
So those you actually... Even if you take generic forces, you will actually say, if this is a seek and destroy force list... They will have this stuff, even if they're generic forces.
Oh, okay, cool. Harrison's got a question.
Quick question. If I was taking Ice Cast, let's say, and I and I can take 500
close
points.
Close on the mic, Harrison.
If I'm taking 1,000 points of Ice Cast, and I'm playing a 1,500 point game, could I take, let's say, a 500 points of Air Cast?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There are certain models that have restrictions. One of the bounty hunters, which we forgot bounty hunters. One of the bounty hunters has, she will not under any circumstance work for Saint, I think it's Mark. because he left her, her story, the reason why she's not with the Forsaken anymore, and now she kind of runs her own bounty hunting spiel, is she got left behind by the decisions of St. Mark. Mark said, you know, she's a goner, leave her behind. And then she suffered very, very badly at the hands of very naughty people. Huh. To put that as PG-13 as possible.
Gotcha. Oh, okay.
And she survived, and now she's a badass bounty hunter, but she will not work for Mark. I won't come in. You know,
because as far as she's concerned, she hates him. She was betrayed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So well, we've got our forces.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the game. Let's talk about the stats a little bit.
Okay. So
we're going to set up our table for our game.
Table is a 4x4 table. Mm-hmm. With a decent amount of terrain, I equate it to a light Necromunda force, or a light Necromunda table.
So that means potentially three-dimensional, but cluttered, what do you think, about one-third of the table with terrain?
Well, I'd almost probably put it closer to half.
Half, okay. Not necessarily sure if everyone who's listened to the show plays a lot of Necromunda.
Gotcha.
But
yeah,
I mean,
never, so...
A lot of multi-floors are nice because in the game there are rules built in for jumping and climbing and things like that. You know, if there's a wall and there's a second floor, you may have to spend several of your activations climbing up this wall to get to the top. And if you're halfway up and someone shoots you, guess what? You fell.
Can we get into that really fast?
Oh, yeah,
just
definitely.
So people start to understand. So in this particular game, what makes this so interesting and why I like to compare it to those games I used to play is that whenever you activate a model, whenever you activate a unit, it has a certain number of actions. And that means that you could potentially move 3 times, shoot 3 times, take 3 swings with an axe, or any combination.
Correct.
And that's part of the charm of this particular game.
Based on the individual limitations of the firing weapons and so forth and so on, yeah.
So when you have a movement of 3 but 3 actions, you could potentially move up to 9 inches, or you could move 6 and take your 1 swing or charge or any combination thereof.
Correct.
So the game is actually quite flexible, and it the first time you play it can be a little intimidating because you have to try and remember, well, what does this mean? What can I potentially do? And the answer is quite a bit.
The average number of actions that people have are 3. Your average human being is going to have 3 actions and probably a move of 3 unless he's heavily armored, then he'll have a move of 2.
Okay.
More often than not. I shouldn't be extremely, generic. But that also means that if you've got somebody who's lightly armored with a gun, they could move out from cover, take a shot. That would be their first activation was move, first action point was move, second action point was shoot, third activation or third action point, don't back into cover. You can play the duck and hide game real well if you're afraid and a coward, which we'll get into cowards later.
And then there are other actions like other actions like aiming to improve your chance of actually hitting, and then going prone, for example, if you want to get more clever, and even hold actions if you want to do a snap action during your opponent's turn.
Like if you know that your opponent's a close combat machine, you're fighting against the Brood. They've got a couple of ranged guns, but pretty much they're going to come up and try and chew on you.
So they're spitters and chewers.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you know that his chewer's right around the corner, and if he activates first, he's going to turn that corner and munch on your face. Then you may spend your last action point that turn to go ahead and hold. And it means that you don't take your action then. You get to hang on to it until you next activate. However, there's a risk. You have to make a check to see if you can use that action or that action point during the opponent's turn.
If you fail the roll to use the action point during his turn, it's wasted.
You're caught off guard.
React faster than they're acting?
Exactly.
Yep.
So, all right, so let's set up our board. We've got our terrain all over our board. We've got our little faction. We started off with a game of 300 points, which for me, I had 6 models and you had 8.
Correct.
You had 8.
I had 8.
Yeah. Okay. So now there's where you would, I guess, deploy is you got to be at least 1 foot in from either the left or right side of the table. And your deployment zone is only 6 inches deep. So you've got about a 2-foot-wide-by-6-inch-deep deployment zone.
It's a shallow little channel that's your deployment zone.
Now, you roll to see who goes first. Now, this is all rolled on D20s, and the low roll rules the day.
Low roll is important here.
So whoever rolls lower wins the initiative, and they get to place first, but you don't have to place first.
You can actually tell your opponent to place a particular activation. So a squad or individual model.
So in this, if I roll, I don't just choose whether I go first or you go first. I go first. If I don't want to go first, I can make you I want to know exactly where you're going to place that. So unlike in Warhammer where you have a lot of throwaway deployments in the beginning to try to throw your guy off.
You can force their hand with the one piece that you're the most concerned about so that you can see for the rest of the turn how best to deploy against it.
Yeah.
And that's really good.
It's
cool.
It's extremely useful.
And the nice thing about this game is that it allows for this. You can have an overpowering unit and you can still dance around it because your initiative allows you to do that sort of thing.
Yep.
Yep.
Now, the other part of the setup is setting up. Each side has 3 50-millimeter round
objective markers.
Objective markers.
Yeah.
That you can gussy up to make look all pretty for your faction.
The objective markers are supposed to be effectively terrain pieces that are 4 inches tall and on a 50-millimeter base. Again, you should gussy it up, to use David's term, although I would never actually use gussy.
You just did.
I did, but only because I'm in your house.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I'm a secret gussier. I sit around at home and just say gussy over and over
all
and over
your
again.
Deployments are gust.
Gust. Gustafson.
They're full of gust.
Son of a gussy.
So, now, they have to be... Now, we alternate placing these. We each get 3, and mm-hmm. we alternate placing them. They have to be at least 8 inches in from the left and right side of the board. And there are how many...
There's an alley in the middle of the board.
No man's land.
No man's land, which is 8 inches from the center line.
So 16 inches wide right down the middle.
Yeah.
But it stops 8 inches shy of either edge of the board. So there will be that 8 inches.
Well,
no
man's land goes the whole stretch, but you can't set up with
exactly.
objective marker.
So
yeah.
Can you deploy terrain in that?
Absolutely. And in fact there should be. There should be lots of terrain. You can have
this game encourages heavy terrain, lanes of fire and also lanes of fire blocked.
Yeah.
Okay.
The more, I don't want to say cluttered to the table, I should say the more interesting terrain.
The game encourages alley fighting.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Well, so you've got a piece of terrain that's like part of a building in the no man's land, and you put your objective marker on like the second floor on the top of the building or something like that?
I don't believe that there's anything that says that you can't. I would have to look a little deeper into the scenarios to see if that's possible or see if that's not possible. Because there's rules for any model to climb, I can't see where that would be against the thing. We have to take a look, but I'm pretty sure you're allowed to.
Okay, so we roll to see who puts the first objective marker.
Mm-hmm.
And then
This is before we needed to roll our scenario first.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
There are 20 different victory condition scenarios for this game.
Which I thought was cool because you roll a d20 and I could play 20 times and never have the same objective to win this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And initially, it is secret from your opponent. So when they're setting up their objective markers, they may or may not. They might actually be helping you if they're trying to put their objectives in the open.
Now, these objectives to win are based around your opponent's objective markers. You
sometimes.
Have to get a lot of them.
Yeah, a lot of them do. Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of them revolve around your enemy's tokens.
So I have now my victory condition. You have your victory condition.
We place our objective tokens.
We take turns going back and forth. You place one, I place one. We place 6 total,
mm-hmm.
and they have to be at least 8 inches apart from each other
and the table edge.
So once all 6 wind up going down,
once everything's set down, we then go, ha ha ha! This is what I'm doing here, and we reveal what our scenario is, and make any random objective token rolls, things like that. Because there's lots of missions that'll have a specific objective. You can't say it's that far one. You have to roll to find out which one it is. So there is a little bit of randomness between.
So it could be the one.
It could be one closest to you, or it could be the one that you screwed up, and it's on the top floor. Of this, you know, again, if you put it on the top floor of a building, thinking that, well, you know, I'm obviously not going to need to get there, and I want to keep him from it. Well, then maybe the random objective is the one over there that's just sitting out in the open. It's not the hard one, you know,
right?
There's a little bit because you don't know what your opponent has to do that could actually, you know, screw things up,
right? So we've got our objectives. We've got what we have to do to win. Now, mm-hmm. if the game's 8 turns,
mm-hmm.
and if neither of us complete our victory objective, then it goes to
what is what
points
has been
of what you've been killed.
Yeah.
Now if
but it defaults to the objective.
The well, the victory conditions for each mission is extremely specific. Like it'll be if you do this,
so
you have won.
The game is over immediately if one or the other player achieves their objective.
Achieves their conditions.
Else it goes by victory points.
If correct,
yeah. Okay. If turn eight finishes and nobody's gotten their objective,
nobody's gotten their objective.
Now,
just to be for detail's sake, sorry to interrupt, David. If a squad, if I kill half of that squad, do I just count the individual models within the squad?
They're worth X number of points, but each unit has a point value.
Each model taken off counts.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was my question, too, is your squad of three harpies were 40 points apiece. If I killed two harpies, I earned 80 points.
Yeah.
So there's no part, it's not, you got to kill half a unit.
So flying that third one away doesn't save you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they've scored what you've got. There's, you know,
what you kill.
Yeah.
I kill what I eat. I'm a hunter-gatherer.
Okay, so in an average game, I don't know if you've mentioned yet, but there is a tournament scene for this. So what would be the average game if you wanted to go that direction, for example?
The big-time tournament scene, the March to Immortality, is a 750-point game.
So that maybe is a good place to aim for?
I would think so.
Okay.
And depending on what kind of force you're putting together, you're probably looking, let's see, I'm trying to think. I played like a 600 and some odd point game with my buddy, and we had about 15 models apiece. So okay. Figure add another 150 points on there, unless it's just going to be somebody, you know, somebody awesome. Then probably you're going to get away with less than 20 models.
So you're,
and it is a skirmish
scarred
game, so that's kind of a lot
for
a skirmish game.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Your scarred box set, for example, how many points roughly?
The scarred box is 290 points.
So it's a pretty healthy start.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
They're all within a few points of 300.
Yes.
So mine, the Forsaken, I got the six models and they are 305 points.
So this is not an expensive game. I mean, you can you can flex your muscle a little bit and have like several different armies if you wanted to play several different things, but if you wanted to focus your one army, that's very attainable right away.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Where things would get more expandable is if you wanted to start trying new force lists, you know, because again, all the starter boxes are generic forces. So let's say, you know, David has decided Mark is the way to go, but let's say he starts playing some Mark and goes, you know, I really like the idea of Luke. Luke is awesome. Arsenals are great. And they are.
And so
that's why you play the scarred hippie.
Cannibal hippies.
But I've still got my Forsaken Warband, which is all the generic characters, so that'll fit with whatever force
absolutely
chart I choose to pick.
And everybody, with the exception of the Warwind, who's like the Forsaken leader that comes in that Warband, that's all a chunk of those individual squads. You can have, like, I want to say four more coils in the unit.
Yeah, it was two to six. I had two.
Yeah,
that, so
you can expand that just by buying a blister of coils, you know,
right,
and just build up from the warband itself.
So if I want to build up, like I buy a box, it's about 300 points.
Okay.
If I want to build up to about 750, what am I looking to spend, roughly?
It'll depend on what style of force you're doing, your big griblies, because that's the other thing. There's not a, unless the models themselves have a limitation to them, like the True Bloods from Dracarys must have three slaves per dude.
I would imagine there's a pretty hefty limitation on those guys.
Yeah, it just depends on
you got to have your squires.
You got to bring your little guys.
Somewhat, you carry my lance.
But like the brood, you can get away with a really low model count with brood. You just take a lot of the big critters, and they fill a lot of your points. You know, broodhounds are hefty big models, and they I think you get two of them in the main warband.
Okay.
And so, they are doggy like.
So in the setup of the game, I mean, in essence, there are four phases of the turn. That's the start of the turn. What do you call that?
The start of the very first phase is the lingering phase, because during the game there are a lot of lingering effects. Things that have happened
poison
during the turn, poison counters, bleeding out. Sometimes there's some interesting psychic effects from some of the other factions that might take place during this turn, or alternate deployment methods. In our demo game, I used harpies. Harpies are little half-naked, winged, Edward Scissorhand-looking things that you can, if you want to, have them deploy in the regular force, and they just kind of run across the field. Or
but that's not what you did.
That's not what I did. Or you can use their rule of gliding deployment, which basically means they're flying above the battlefield, and at some point during the game, they come down on the field. And the lingering phase is when you would announce that. You would say, hey, my harpies are coming down next turn. So in turn one, in the beginning of the game, as I did in the demo, I said, my harpies are coming down in turn two. And that means right. In the lingering phase of turn two, that's when they're going to land.
Okay.
Or if there's any other effects going on.
So once we get past all the lingering effects, then we roll for initiative.
We roll for initiative.
No, we'll roll.
All dice rolls are resolved on a...
D20.
Thank you.
Flat surface.
So it's a D20. We both roll. Whoever gets the lowest. Now, once again, I won the first turn initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of going first...
Dude, you won everything.
I got really lucky. Brian had some really horrendous rolls. I had some really good rolls. And that wasn't the only reason it was a good demo.
It was
a good,
yeah. As far as demos go, it was a success. As far as the game goes, it was
totally
not.
Hooked me.
I would have been a loser if this was a campaign game.
But so my first move was you had that big monster. I wanted to see which way that big monster was going to go because, quite frankly, it was very good reasons to be afraid of him. So rather than moving first, because a lot of my guys were shooty and I was way out of range, so I won the initiative. Instead of going first, just like with the placing guys, I could pick one of your units and say...
The winner of the initiative roll gets to choose what activation goes. Doesn't matter what side.
So I picked your... I said, move him first. So you move
now,
him first.
Now, obviously, as the controlling player, I still get... You know, he doesn't get to move my guy. I still get to move him. And it basically then resets the... That's now the initiative order. I go, he goes, I go, he goes.
But the advantage here is, since that's the problem unit that he has to deal with, by you having been... You know that his action is practically wasted. He's going to run up, but he's not going to hurt anybody.
And it also, if, you know, as the games... As you play the game more and you realize there's more, tactical options and things like that, you might see someone setting up a 1-2 punch. You know, these guys are going to run over and knock somebody over, and then that guy's going to run over and jump on their head. And that's absolutely a good tactic.
Whereas later in the game...
I win the initiative, and I say that second punch, that second part of the punch, I make him go.
I make him go right now.
Yep.
Because he's like, oh, but I wanted to jump on your head when you fell down. Now he has to do a little extra work, and possibly he might have, for instance, I'm going to use a reference here, St. Luke has a force of guys called Stingers. Stingers have big, long spears. Their big long spears have two ways of attack, poking you or skewering you if you're on the ground. That attack group can only be used if you're prone, and it hits way harder. So if you know they've got guys that can knock somebody over and then there are stingers nearby, you say, activate the stingers because I really don't want to be skewered on the ground.
Exactly. I love this. I love this mechanic. I remember I first read it. I was a little confused.
I've always loved this particular style of system, and there are two games that came before this that I used to play to the exclusion of all else for a long time, and I'm delighted to see that it's actually back in some form. I really like it. So.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
so now the activations go back and forth.
Until everybody has activated.
And that's one turn.
So correct.
Big advantage, as far as I'm concerned, of a game like this is that you're both engaged right away. I mean, you move someone, and... You're sitting idly for maybe a minute, and then you're back in the game.
Oh, yeah.
There's no walking away from the table to make a sandwich while somebody moves 120 clan rats.
Yeah. No, in Warhammer, there's often the sandwich phase where it's like, I'll be back.
Sandwich phase. I'm keeping that.
That's how I feel about War Machine. But,
sandwich phase.
I love it. That's my gift. We're going back and forth. Now, one of the interesting things I thought, and basically that's the game. You've got 8 turns, alternating activation to either complete your objective. Now, in our game, your objective was to get to one of my markers, stay on that marker for 3 turns, and after you've stayed on that marker for 3 full turns, you get a token. And then you run to the closest of your markers
and
deliver the token to that marker, and you've won.
And as soon as that token would touch my marker...
Game over.
Victory has been met.
Mine was to get to one of your markers, spend an activation point, which is one of my things I can do, to get the token, and then run that token back to my home deployment zone.
Yeah.
So yours, you had to stay there longer, but you didn't have to go back. Mine, I had to go to get it and get it back home again.
Yeah.
Now, in the way it turned out. I got a lot of lucky rolls, and I just out, slaughtered your entire team. So
I didn't make it.
No.
So I actually didn't have to win by the victory.
Yeah,
conditions.
in this case, before the game was, you know, before the turns were over, he had eliminated everything in my force, so he didn't have to follow his victory conditions. Now,
I was actually going for my victory conditions, but it just, I lucked out. Was as your guys were coming up, I got a couple of good shots off, a couple of good hits off, and
well,
suddenly all
guy,
your guys were dead.
You're a big guy. Now, in this game, there's a system of rolling a 1 or rolling a 20 if you're rolling a d20,
mm-hmm.
and if you roll a 20, that's especially bad. There's a sort of a botch or a
fumble. It's a critical failure.
Critical failure.
And most rolls have something wrong with it if they critical failure. Sometimes it's as easy as your gun backfires. Other times it's you are affected by your own spell.
With mine with the hand weapons, there were no misfire. But with my one hand weapon, I rolled a 20. And that means I lost one of my activation points. Now, if it's the last activation point of the turn,
you got away
character's model, then I got away with it.
Yeah.
But on the next roll, because I did get away with it, but on the next I went up, and on his first roll of his three moves, he rolled a 20. So, boom, that counted it for his add extra activation point. Now, with my guy, I shot at you, got a nice lucky shot off, hit you with the rotary saw blade.
The death disc.
And most models only have one hit point. They take a hit point, mm-hmm. they drop. Some have two, your models, your character models. I mean, guys, really big stuff can have up to five, we found out. But no one on our board had more than two.
Yeah.
Your leader guy had two. I hit him. You rolled a 20 for your armor save, which meant you took 2 points.
He took two wounds and dies.
Yeah, and you that was the beginning of the end.
He took.
That's okay.
He took two wounds.
He took two wounds.
This is Toki.
But with libraries?
But
it also goes to say that when a model loses his last hit point, he doesn't, unless there's a special rule that says otherwise, he doesn't die. He falls over and is dying. He does not actually perish
until
he either takes another point of damage or his next activation, which means you have an entire round if you have medics or some chemical stimulants. There's a special action called numb that basically, you run over and you punch a dude full of drugs and he gets back up because, he's going to die.
So he's all juiced up for a turn. All right.
Now, what's interesting is that guy had 2 points. Now, if I had managed to take off one and he was walking around with one left and then I did that critical hit and took off two, then he's dead.
He would have been dead. He lost. He would have no more hit points to lose, plus he lost an additional one.
Yeah. Once you lose the one over your regular... You're out.
He's
an interesting mechanic, though, because it allows for the danger of allowing a medic to stay on the field. Sometimes it's like, I could take all of these people out, but unless I can also take out that medic, he's just going to activate him and bring them all back.
And there's also an element in the core rulebook about campaign play, and models that are dying at the end of a game, they come back. They're not dead.
Ah.
So you can be really mean and... specifically target dying guys.
Well, and that's the thing. Now, you had no medics, so when I knocked your guys down and killed, I just waited for the next activation phase and you took them off the board.
And there's no reason to club the dying guy.
So, however, I could, if there was some way for you to bring him back, he's on the ground, he's dying, I'm going to stomp on his head.
Absolutely.
Make sure he doesn't get back up.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, there are certain individuals who allow for these special rules like medic, and then there are other activation or individuals who allow for rallying.
Yeah.
So there's several other special rules that come into play in the larger games you can start to take advantage.
Absolutely.
Neat.
It's actually really simple. Now, I will say this, never having played this system before, there was a few things that confused me. Just in the first, because you got to kind of get used to, you always got to get used to a rule.
You
got to
figure out how the math goes.
It's different. It is very different.
So when I am attacking, I have an assault value. Whether it be a ranged weapon or a hand weapon, I have an assault value.
Well, we should go back one step.
Every
model has a number of attack groups.
Okay.
Everybody at least has one. Most people have two. They'll have, if they have a ranged weapon, they definitely have two. When you spend when you spend an action point, you activate an entire attack group, and you make all the attacks in that group. Most people will have one weapon in there, whether it's a club or a sword or a
so then you roll the one die for that one attack.
Yeah.
But like some of my guys had two listed, this exact same weapon listed twice. This guy has, or the character?
The Banes have a double mace. Basically, they've got a long stick that has two angry ends. And so when you activate the double mace attack group, he swings twice.
Yeah, you get two attacks because one for each end. Now, you always take the lowest number first because you
always apply the lowest dice first. So in the case of, let's say you rolled a 3, which is probably a hit. We'll get to that mechanic in a minute. And then your other die is a 20. It doesn't mean that you lost your activation point first. You apply the hit and then the 20.
Right. So, okay. Because you want to roll low.
Yeah. Low is good.
In every situation. In this particular game, a low roll is always what you want to get.
I cannot think for any reason.
Well, it seems like the mechanic was designed so that anytime you roll, you're going low. As opposed to Warhammer, where you need a low roll for leadership, but you need a high roll to hit.
I'm trying to think. There's a couple special rules. The Kaboom rule is a high roll, but it's not a high roll that you want.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, it has a different number system on there because instead of making a save to do something, you're making a save against it.
So all tests are all conflict-based rolls where you're trying to hit someone or trying to protect yourself. You want to roll low.
Yes, okay. Low rolls are good.
Now, this is actually the first part where I got a little confused because whenever you do these different moves, it's one of my stats and one of your stats combined, it seems to be, for a lot of these things.
Combined in some fashion. They will relate in some fashion.
So, like, when I attacked you first, I have my hand weapon, and I've got a specific assault number, and I want to roll that or lower. And what confused me was I add your
defense.
Your defense to it. And I was like, well, why would I add your defense? That makes it easier for me to hit because a really high assault number is good because I want to roll that or lower, but on the card, a very low defensive number is a good number to have.
You are adding less to your opponent's chance to hit. That's
right.
Your low defense numbers are very, very good.
You're producing a number, and you want to roll that number or less. So the less you add to that number, the harder
better.
The number it is to roll it.
Like my best guy had an armor of 2, which is actually excellent. Because
defensive two.
Defensive two.
Armor too bad. Defense too good.
Armor too bad.
sorry. I get confused. I'm still a little confused. So with my defensive 2, whatever your assault was, I added 2 to that, so it made it. But now we had other guys with a defensive 6 or 7, and suddenly, boom, it becomes way easier to hit them. So
generally speaking, the larger or the heavier, less speedy or agile something is, they will have a higher defense. But they probably have a much thicker armor because of that.
Okay, so I roll my hit. I've got a 6 assault, and you've got a 4 armor, so I need a 10.
4 defense.
A 4 defense. Damn it. I have a 6 assault, and you have a 4 defense, so now I need to roll a 10 or less. And
there's modifiers involved.
There are modifiers. Yeah. If you charge in, you get a bonus. If the guy's laying on the ground, he gets a penalty, that kind of stuff. But for the most part, I roll
a red hat on Tuesday.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I roll my 10 or less, and
the red ones go faster.
Hey, yes. Whoa.
That's an orc reference. I read it once.
I recognize the reference.
Okay, thanks.
Did you play? Oh, yeah, you like the orcs.
Wag.
No, I don't like
the orcs. He does not like the orcs.
I am not an orc fan.
I don't
but not because of their narrative, because they're only 6 points of
peace. Oh. I don't think you need to worry, man. They're about to get a new edition, right?
I can't wait for 6th edition. I want to see what happens.
I can wait.
So, so my assault. Now, so you want a very low defense, but then if I hit, then you take your armor and you want to roll your armor or less. But then whatever the strength of my weapon is subtracted from your armor. So if your armor is 14 and my weapon, you would have to roll 14. But if my weapon strength is 4, now you've got to roll a 10 or less.
Yeah.
So that was, as I say, as a first time playing this or any system like this, because I've never played. I know, Christopher, obviously you have.
You know, War Machine and Chronopia, the system was slightly different for computing what you need to roll. But the activation based is what I'm used to, where you go back and forth and actions.
Me and Warzone and Chronopia.
What did I just say?
War Machine.
Gargadar. You're right.
Because I was trying to figure out how War Machine was the same. I'm like, no,
it's not the same. That. I'm using the wrong words, but that's fine.
So, but
people
can
read my mind.
So,
no, I'm used to the system generally, but the mechanics for deducing the number you need to roll or less is slightly different in this version.
Yeah.
But so, sometimes you want really high stats, sometimes you actually want really low stats. But it all winds up being you want to roll
You want low defense, you want high armor.
One of the cool things I liked in this was the malfunction option. Not option, but the malfunction rule, which is the more technologically advanced the weapon is,
the more likely it is that it's been...
The more moving parts, the more stuff can break.
And because we're in this world where we don't always know how to upkeep our stuff...
Because if it's complicated, it was probably built about 1,000 years ago.
So, in fact, on Mark, he's got two different weapons. And his one, the cutter arm, has a malfunction of 19. So if I roll a 19 or a 20, something goes wrong with my weapon.
St. Mark is an individual model.
A unique individual.
Yes.
So it's very unlikely that his stuff is going to break, as it's probably been...
But if you also have a club or a stick or a mace, anyone, I didn't have any hand weapons that had a malfunction rating at all. They had a dash there because...
Oh, that's a close combat weapon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. A close combat weapon.
It's a chainsaw. Sweet. It's a circular saw, chainsaw arm thing.
Sweet.
So it could break, but it's got a low chance it is still a handle. But the guns had malfunctions. I think I had one was a 16.
That's probably 18.
Okay.
18's about the low average.
Okay.
There's a couple of 17s out there that I know, but most things are 18s and 19s if they've got moving parts.
And what happens when you malfunction with a weapon like
that? When you malfunction it, if you malfunction on a 20, you malfunction... And it's a critical failure, so you've lost the extra activation point. That brutally sucks. If it's just a malfunction, then you miss no matter what the die roll is, and you hit yourself. Something has busted in the gun.
Oh, that's yucky.
Yeah, so either, you know, in the case of like a flamethrower, you've sprayed, you know, the nozzle leaked and you got fire on you. In the case of your death disc, which is... a saw blade that is launched by a compressed spring. either, you know, it launched backwards or, you know, cut the back of your hand or whatever the case may be, something bad happened and you hit yourself. Now, it doesn't mean you necessarily die. You could, if you've got a heavy armor, then, you know, you shrug it off. And
so
it
you
just,
still get the armor saved.
You absolutely still, you absolutely okay. save yourself, but you hit yourself with a weapon.
Does it ruin the weapon?
No. It just, you... They are considered to, you know, reload it or retweak it or unjam it, whatever they need to do.
For those who are interested in this game, I can assume that I know for a fact that you'll have a presence at Gen Con.
Oh, yeah.
How about Adepticon?
I believe Cool Mini will have a booth at Adepticon. I'd have to talk to Ross. He's the guy who's kind of running most of the most of the convention stuff.
I know they'll have what is the term? A vendor's booth, but what about gaming tables?
Gaming tables, that I don't know.
Okay.
I would hope so. The March to Immortality, the tournament circuit, which ends at Gen Con and has an awesome prize. The March to Immortality is in full swing and ends next Gen Con.
What would be the best way to get involved if you were interested in the March to Immortality?
Go to www.dark-age.com and there's a link down to the bottom that has all the PDF downloads and stuff for the cool. How to run a March event.
Where's the, I don't know what the term you're going to use is, but the finals, the main event for to finalize the
invitational
March.
Finals are at Gen Con, and they're going to, basically the way it works, I talked to BJ about this recently, is the March to Immortality, anybody can run one of these tournaments. If they've got enough players, it qualifies as an official event. At an actual official March to Immortality event, I want to say it has to be at least 12 registered people. Don't quote me on that, but I think it's at least 12 registered players.
Ladies and gentlemen, he was known to say at least 12 people.
The winner of that tournament gets basically a ticket to go to the Invitationals at Gen Con. They fill out the form and they send it to Dark Age, and they will take those forms to Gen Con and have, you know, a list of people that qualified. At Gen Con, they're going to run several qualifiers before the actual tournament. So they're going to run a couple of mini tournaments on, like, Thursday and Friday to try and get some people who may not have had enough Dark Age players in their area, but they want to make it to the Invitational so they can come out, play a mini tournament, try and place at Gen Con, and then... On Saturday, the big event itself happens. That's the actual Invitational.
Sounds
cool.
How many years has it been going on for?
March to Immortality started, I want to say, in 2007.
Okay. So it's been tried and practiced for a bit. So
there's been at least three winners.
Cool.
The winner of the March to Immortality circuit like the guy who wins the Invitational gets to help the Dark Age designers, and I guess possibly myself, fiction-wise, design a new model for the next release.
Whoa! Okay, that's pretty cool.
There are several models in the game. So
if I win the March to Immortality, I can propose the new model.
You can say let's say that you go to you get your ice cast all painted up and they're fancy, and you go to the March to Immortality and you school a bunch of dudes. You win. You walk away. They/we. I'm going to say they because I don't know if I'm going to know if I'm involved in that process yet. They'll sit down with you and you basically tell them, Leo, so, you know, I like the ice cast a lot, but I really think it'd be cool if there was a fire cast traitor that joins the game. They will sit down and help design. They're going to take care of the game statistics and things like that.
I don't know if I was ice cast. I don't know if I'd want fire cast in the ice cast. Well, it seems like it's playing with fire.
I love this ice cast, but I always wish there was an ice cast guy who had this type of thing.
Yeah.
And you don't have one of these guys.
There's no one that has, you know, maybe they've got the little shard bombs that the slaves get. Maybe give a true blood version. You know, this giant shard grenade dude or whatever. You know, this has been a big deal. Two of the winners have gotten models that one just recently got announced on the website, Phaedrus and Maximo. It's one of the super mutant guys and one of the little kind of Juve scouts for the outcasts. Mm-hmm. They're a paired bounty hunter team. Very Master Blaster style. There's
a little
dude and a big
scout
guy and a super mutant that hang out together, and they're a pair of bounty hunters that fight together and go out and do their job. That was the guy who won last year.
That's really neat.
The year before, because they took last year off because Apocalypse is coming out.
So it's a relatively simple game to learn.
It really is. Once you get the math down, the part that you have to kind of get down is a lot of the individual models. Unlike things like 40K and Fantasy, where they have a lot of universal special rules, there are some universal special rules, but a lot of things are very specific to the individual dudes. Like you may find
there are several pages of special
there
rules.
There's a big chunk of special rules,
but you only need to know the ones that apply to your miniatures.
Yeah. And especially
you
if you
the
trust
rule book
your
right there, if you don't know what it means, it's
exactly
all
well,
in one place.
Exactly.
I think that's part of the part of the appeal of this particular system is that you don't need several phases within the game within the turn. It's like you can move, you can shoot, you can fire, you can go prone, you can do this, you can do that. It's an action.
Oh, that guy
do
can
with
burrow?
It as you will.
Cool. What does that mean?
Yeah. It's like it's just
and unlike having to find that rule in that faction's book because no, all the rules are in the main rule book,
mm-hmm.
and then.
The special abilities are in the Force List book because that's where you're going to find out if you have special abilities.
Right. One detail that no one mentioned, we should bring it up now. This is a game where it's a bit more hardball. You pull out your tape measure, you can't
you've
measure.
Nominated an action.
Yeah. There's no pre-measuring. This is old school.
Yeah. If you say, I'm going to try and rally my troops, and they've got to be within 8 inches, and you go, they're close, and you put that tape measure down, and it's 8.5 to that closest dude, they didn't hear you. They are too busy pooping.
So, all right.
Yeah, I said that.
Yeah, she did.
I tried to sneak one in.
That's cool. Okay, so we've gone through the fluff, which I think is really fantastic. I really love the fluff in this game.
It's only getting better.
Yeah, there's more coming out. Speaking of more coming out.
That was a narcissistic comment.
Not to stroke your ego too much. Not to stroke it too much, but I will say if you're writing the fiction for
I think you stroked his plenty.
Oh, dear God. Never mind.
No, please continue. I need this.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what you produce. Speaking of which, obviously something has to be coming down the pipe.
What can you tell
what
us?
What can you give us?
Come on, give us a...
Well, I just talked about Phaedrus and Maximo, the 2010 winner. I believe it's 2010. Either 2010 or 2009. The last guy who won created Phaedrus and Maximo.
Right.
And they are going to be released in the upcoming book, which I do not know if it has a title yet. I'm not sure.
So whatever the working title is for the next expansion, and I assume that means that it will cover all the bases for all the races.
I don't know all of the specifics. I only know what I've been privy to thus far. There is definitely some expansion to existing factions.
Okay, so it's designed more like, what would be a good comparison? What's that?
Yeah, a little bit like the
Wrath,
a little bit like the War Machine expansion books, where a lot of, if not all of the factions, at least some of the factions are getting are getting some love.
So far, the books cover as much as possible, rather than a simple army faction. Whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I can say with all with all NDAs available, I can't go into
non-disclosure agreements for those out there.
Non-disclosure agreements. The world is not done growing, and there are more factions coming.
That makes sense to me, considering the way you're describing this world, where we don't know what's out there. We don't even barely know what's on this continent. It sounds like there's a lot of room to expand.
There absolutely is.
Okay.
There absolutely is. There's lots of hints in the Force List book about other stuff that exists out there. We were mentioning earlier about St. Mark's story, which is awesome. His gun that he finds when he finds his gun, which is super awesome, energy weapon, laser technology, which we explained earlier that bullets are hard to come by. So a guy with a laser gun, this guy rules the school. I mean, like, he calls his gun God's Light.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. That
is the name of his pistol.
Understanding non-disclosures are in effect here. Yeah. When we do see your work coming out, it will be in the form of fiction for New Forces, that sort of thing, or whatever, new rules, new this, new that.
Currently, what I have been contracted to do thus far, and we've been expanding every time. Every time I finish a contract, they throw me a new one. So that's, this is all good.
Yay.
So this game is growing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. The fiction that I have written thus far, trying to word this properly, the fiction I have written thus far touches on things that no one has heard about yet.
That's very exciting news. Okay.
That's something I can say.
without giving us detail on what it is that is releasing, can you give us a rough date of when you are hoping to have this product out?
We haven't really talked about release dates or anything, but I'm assuming that it's probably going to be, I'm assuming Gen Con.
Okay.
We haven't talked about anything like that because I'm not part of that part of the process.
Yes.
Yet. But
aim for the stars.
Aim for the stars. As long as they keep throwing work at me, I will happily move their deadlines forward. As long as they keep saying this needs to get done, I will keep doing.
Well, if you wanted to suggest to your overseers that Garage Hammer makes an excellent playtest group.
I do have access to a lot of the playtest information.
Well, between David and I, we can conquer anything. So
yes,
and awesome, awesome art. I wish I could show people things.
How much is Brom still involved?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm assuming a decent amount because the stuff that I've seen looks a lot like his stuff, but I don't know. I personally have never had a chance to talk to the guy, so. I don't know.
Yes. No, Harrison is raising her because he's also happy to help play test. He's always willing to try something new.
I just want to see Garage Hammer in a book.
Yep. All right. Brian, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the game. Dude, I really enjoyed playing this a lot.
I really, really like where it is and where it's headed. And I believe that if the models continue to get better, I mean, because a lot of the models that you saw today, some of them are pretty old sculpts. Mm-hmm. They're older sculpts from when the game originally was designed.
Let me, I guess I'm going to stroke the ego of the game again, but if these are old sculpts, then you guys are in fine and healthy condition because they're beautiful miniatures.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
Fantastic.
They're really
the
good.
Ones that
there are some of the reason that I stopped the first time I did at the Cool Mini or Not booth. Ooh, what are those? Oh, Dark Age.
The most recent releases that hit the website were a bunch of stuff for St. Luke. Mm-hmm. St. Luke is the newest saint for Apocalypse. He actually was designed for the Apocalypse set of rules.
Okay.
And his forces and him, obviously, were never sculpted back in the day. So they are some of the newest sculpts that Dark Age has. The Stingers and St. Luke himself are some of the coolest. If I hadn't already decided that Johan was my man, Luke would probably have been. He's awesome. His model is just fantastic.
Yeah, it's real. They're really, I mean, they're just gorgeous. They're gorgeous. Well, listen, before we wrap up here, we actually have a contest to
Yes, we do.
Now, forever ago, when Chris came back from Gen Con, we said when we did the next Garage Gamer, thinking it would be about a month, and then real life took over.
And never let go again.
We told people to try Kings of War, and anyone who tried Kings of War and wrote a review on it would get entered to win a copy of Dwarf King's Hold.
That's right.
Which was the Mantic game, which Harrison actually got a copy for Christmas. So I get to paint another one after painting Cranky's two sets.
Say what?
I painted this Dwarf King's Hold set and the Green Menace for Cranky.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Harrison got one for his birthday.
Oh,
so I get to paint another set.
I was going to say, don't promise to paint the winner's paint set.
No, no, I get to paint Harrison.
Make him do it.
It's
Harrison can paint.
Well, he could. He should practice. Yeah, I airbrushed a lot of it. It was quick. But so we actually had 10 people who entered. So I'm going to roll the D20, split them up 2x2.
Yep, 1, 2.
And we will have a winner of that contest in just a momento.
And the roll? The result is...
Deuce Mordante.
No kidding. Mordante, congratulations.
Mordante from the forums. So, Mordante, he was actually the first person to enter this contest.
And thank you for...
Months and months ago.
Thank you for signing up.
I believe that's pronounced Mordant.
Mordant? He won.
M-O-R-D-A-N-T-E.
Second place was Socrates.
You be
the winner. Socrates Johnson. Yeah.
So
Bob Genghis Khan,
send us your
dust in the wind, dude.
So send us a PM. If you're still on the forums, just send us a PM, and we will get that out in the mail to you.
And if you are an early riser, send them an AM.
Ba-dum-bum.
Ping chang.
Or just contact us at garagehammer@live.com.
That works too. All right, I think that's everything.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you. I can't thank you enough coming all the way out here, driving out here the 3.5-4 hours to come out and do the show, and to really just, I mean, the demo was fun. The fluff is fantastic. I really had a good time playing it.
I have to admit, I'm surprised. I mean, I'm the kind of person right now where I look at a miniature game and I think, can I fit it in? I'm playing a lot of miniature games. This one catches me. This is one I'm going to have to keep my eyes on because I really like what I saw. So
awesome.
I'm excited for the product, and I'm very excited to see that you're doing the fiction. I mean, there are some games out there where I like the rules, but if the fluff is that bad, then I don't bother. So this is very promising for me. I mean, I am biased.
Thank you.
I happen to like your writing. So
thank you.
Jeepers.
I'm blushing.
All right. So having said that, I think this wraps this up. Folks, we'll have a Garage Hammer out in another week or so as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to that one, too.
Oh, me too. So, folks, thanks for listening. If you want to hear more of this, more Garage Gamers, you can always put us suggestions in the So What You Want section of our forums. Also, if we get people who actually wish to donate to this specifically, if you do a donation through the forums, when you donate, if you actually just put in for Garage Gamer under the little tag or let us know it's for Garage Gamer, once we get a certain amount of donations, this will certainly become
a regular
installment. Once we know there's enough people who want it, once we've hit it where we can actually financially afford another episode a month.
Now that the sweet mercy of life has actually allowed the holidays to finally be over, normalcy can finally reign its head again.
All right, so Brian, thanks for coming. Thank you so much,
guys.
And
till next time.
David, we'll be recording later this week.
We'll see about that.
Show's due out in less than a week. Show's due out in 8 days. We have to be recording sometime this week, so...
I don't know if I can commit, but we'll see what we can do.
All right. Talk to you guys soon. Thanks for coming.